You know, it's not the tongue that communicates so much as your moods. Is that true? Mm-hmm. Your moods, your feelings. So all the speech, all the energy of my being and of my mind, but if you're a Buddhist, your mind is here. With my body, with my speech and my mind, I stand on this ground and open to the teacher. So this is what I'm saying. And if you have respect for me, you watch me do that to just see whether it's true or not. Or you feel that that is like respectful to pay attention to that. But in Buddhism, question is one of the most respectful things you can do. Not skepticism. Not skepticism, but question, right? So then after I've done that, I usually say thank you. For those of you who want to sit down, you can sit down. And those of you who are sitting anyway, thank you. And then I sit down, and you can choose whether you also want to bow, right? You also want to make that statement. Or some people like to bow to me because they have that day I've been actually useful to them. So at the moment they have a sense of the openness of their heart toward me. Maybe the next day they don't. It doesn't matter. But it's like a personal statement. Because when you're touching the ground with your head, what you're meaning is you say, you're basically saying, I have the faith to surrender my separateness. Isn't that true? And we think of it as obsequience, as like, you know, you're giving up something. But you're not giving up anything, you're offering openness. So that's basically what it's talking about. Okay, I'm open to see what happens. And I think we can become open because of desperateness or because of joy or because of so many different reasons. It really doesn't matter why you're doing it. So if you want to bow to me, you bow to me. If you don't want to bow to me, you don't. If you want to bow to the shrine, you do that. It's personal. Totally personal. There are people that use ritual because they know they're in a really shaky state of mind, and focusing on the ritual helps them stabilize themselves. I know several people who do that. There are people who use ritual because they hope that that's the right thing and then they'll be okay. I know several people like that. In fact, I look inside and there's very few people I can't see. The ones I can't see, I start wondering about, why can't I see that part of me? Because really, there isn't any one part of you or I that isn't part of everyone else somewhere. Some crow, some mosquito. Is that true? But we don't tend to see others as having as much reality as we have, do we? We tend to be so aware of our own hopes and fears that we don't tend to see outside of ourselves until we do something so wonderful that everybody praises us or so awful that everybody screams at us. And it's easier to see. I've been bitching about the cushions. Okay, so What text were you given there?
The
Ant Hill. The Ant Hill? Now my question is, how many of you were here for the last one? I don't think any of you were you?
No.
You were, Francine, right? Mm-hmm. But you weren't.
No, Mr. Austin.
Yeah. So it's you and I, and didn't we end the last one by saying, so we covered the whole thing, but I'm sure there's some questions? Do you remember that? And we might need to go over it again. So what do you think? Do you want to hear the one before that? Did you find it interesting, the last one?
I'm not sure where the text is.
Look in the closet. I've never met you before, have I?
No.
I'm Cecily.
Same.
Yeah.
Very nice to meet you. I didn't know that's who is who.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I was invited by, or the information came from Karen Jacobson.
Okay.
So
oh, lovely. Oh, that's lovely. Good people. And they have a lot of respect for what they do. Did you find some?
I think this is the one. Yeah. Yeah, that's the one.
So I wonder how many there are. Well, let's look at 22 again, because it's a real humdinger. It starts out, you think it's going to go one way. Do you remember that, Francine? It starts out, you think it's going to go one way, and then it totally goes a different direction. So on Thursday night, which is tonight, we do the... I decided, because I'm able to make such statements, that I would like people to have a better sense of... I've got one, so if you don't have one, Ivan, you might want one. I would like people, if they are doing some kind of practice of Buddhism, I would like them to know something about what it is considered that the Buddha Sakyamuni himself actually taught, rather than how it's translated into the other schools after his time. So the oldest written tradition that there is in Buddhism is called the Theravadin tradition. And it includes... It has what they call the three baskets of teaching. Three baskets, because there's three different sections, set categories. One section is about the rules of if you're going to be somebody who wants to be a monk or a nun. These are the rules you should follow because this will help make it work. And every one of the rules, when the Buddha started teaching, he wasn't the Buddha, he was some Hindu who had this great idea and eventually became known as the Buddha. And there was no Buddhism, and there was no order, and there wasn't any monks or nuns, right? And so what happened was a bunch of people caught fire by his teaching, his understanding, his common sense, his profound energy abilities, his quality of heart. And so they would just drop whatever they were doing in their life and start following him, which still happens today all over the world. But they were a pretty ragtag bunch, and they maybe had some difficulties from their background. Maybe, you know, they hadn't ever really been able to hold down a job or hold up a job or hold in a job or hold out a job or whatever. You know, they probably had some problems. And they weren't really interested in staying in one place and making enough money and buying enough food to go with the Buddha. They were driven by their passion to follow. So they come into some town and one time the Buddha was about to go to, he used to just travel around, he was about to go to a town that he went to quite often. It was sort of on one of his regular ways of travel. And the people from the town came rushing out to meet him about 10 kilometers outside of the town and said, "Please stay here, we've prepared a beautiful place for you." And he said, "Thank you," and he sat up, and then he said, "But why have you prepared a place here?" And they said, "Well, you know, we're really happy that you come around and your teaching is so wonderful and things go better when you're around, but you know, last time you left, all the laundry disappeared from all the lines, and we found all these old raggy pieces of clothing that were like rat infested, lice infested, lying around in the streets, and you know, all the food was stolen from people's kitchens, because all these people were a bunch of beggars, basically. They didn't have any clothes, and they really felt like the teaching was the most important thing, so they just didn't pay attention, right?" So first thing the Buddha says is, "Okay, you beggars," because that's what the word bhikkhu means, which is translated as monk. It means beggar. "Okay, you beggars, come here. I got something to tell you." "You're not allowed to take any cloth that you find unless it is on the body of a corpse that has been ignored for at least 3 years. The corpse has to be bones." See, like he's like... And so this is the rules of the order, one of the three baskets. It has the story of why he made every rule. It's fascinating if you're really interested in how communities work with a bunch of anarchists. I mean, it has every possible story about everybody having a different idea, doing it this way or doing it that way, and how the Buddha said, okay, look, you know, it's a beautiful idea, and if you want to be a member of my group of people, this is what you have to respect. And so that is, I think, five volumes? I think it's five volumes. Then another part of the three baskets is called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. It was actually collated and collected sometime after the Buddha's death, but it is considered to be still the Buddha's teaching. And it has seven volumes. And then all the rest of it is the Sutta Pitaka. And the Sutta Pitaka has 20 some volumes. So in the Buddhist Bible, there's something like 25, 30, 34 volumes, like books. This is one of the books. This is called the Majjhima Nikaya, which means the middle length discourses. This is from the third one of the three baskets that I talked about. This is the kind of things that he would say when he was walking around the streets and just meeting people or talking to his monks. Just sort of the middle length talk. Nothing too big. And there's another one called the big ones, and there's another one called the small ones, and there's some called the scattered ones, and you know. And this has 152 talks in it. So my beloved teacher told me some time ago that if you really wanted to understand Buddhism, you should just read the Majjhima Nikaya. And it will really give you a clear delineation of what in Buddhism is meant by morality, what is meant by meditation, what is meant, you know, all those things. Like, you give a real sense of the vision of Buddhism, why you would be moral, why you would why you would want to practice different meditations. If you do this meditation, what happens? If you do that meditation, what happens? In very ordinary kind of terms. Meditation is basically how you want to turn your mind. If you think about all the things you don't have, you know what that creates in your being, don't you? If you think about all the things you don't have, what does that create? Does that create happiness or dissatisfaction?
Dissatisfaction.
If you think of all the things you do have, does that create happiness or dissatisfaction? So you have in Buddhism, from this school, 40 classical meditations, each of ways to hold your mind so that you can use your life the way you want to, rather than being driven by hope and fear. So those are talked about to some degree in this text, but mostly they're referred to as, and they're not outlined, they're referred to as, this is a good meditation. Why? Because it does this. This one does that. This one is good for this type of mind state. This is good for that one. Is that a good enough background for some of you that have no idea what this is about? Does that give you an idea? So Thursday night is Buddhist night. Friday night is my night. I decided that it's enough Buddhism for a while. I would like to teach people some Western stuff. So we're doing Western mysteries. In particular, we're doing tarot. The tarot is actually a meditation system, and we just started it. Saturday night is your night. You get to ask me anything you want. I get to answer if I want. And Sunday is meditation together, where it's Sunday afternoon where we do a meditation together. So that's sort of, you know, especially for you two, that's sort of like an idea of what we're doing here and why. I hope tonight is not too dry for you, as you sometimes, when people first meet the Majjhima Nikaya, they feel it's kind of dry, but as you hear it, it starts getting some strength, doesn't it? Have you found that? And the times that you've been, have you found that, Jeff? And you?
Well, especially if someone is there that understands it, or has some in-depth things to pull it out and say, well, that's what I mean, expand, you know.
Expand on it.
Yeah.
So I hope I do that.
Okay.
Have I done that for you sometimes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's You can read it. Myself, I find also, like I can read it. I think I sort of understand it, but when someone like you,
when we're reading it together, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's not just me. It's when a group of people read something together. You've got minds with more than one mindset.
Right, things open in different ways.
It's not that you have to agree with everybody. It's that. That you have a chance of seeing that there are other ways of looking at the same thing, so that your mind opens more to possibility. Isn't that true? It's my experience. So, is that okay then if we look at
the simile of the sin?
Yeah. It's a long one. Okay, thus have I heard. Oh, sorry. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo, my name. Tassa, the state. Bhagavato, of blessedness. Arahato, of where the outer and the inner are in accord. Samma, totally sambuddhassa, with the discovering mind. Sambuddhassa, I name the state of awakening. It's usually translated as Namo tassa. Bhagavato, arahato, sammasambuddhassa. Because you always start a class by naming what you'd like to move it toward or get out of it. So thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One, that means the Buddha, was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. So this is the way all sutras basically start. They sort of tell you who was there, where they were, and if you know enough about the history of that time, then you know where that place came from, or why it was a place that the Buddha went to, or what the history was. But I forget all that almost as soon as I learn it, so some people I find it very interesting, and some people are not so involved with it. Now on that occasion, a pernicious view. By the way, if there's a word you don't understand, you of course just ask me right away.
This one.
Hmm?
Pernicious.
Pernicious means nasty, sticky, bothersome, wrong, biting, pernicious. And hung on, it hangs on, it doesn't let go. A pernicious view had arisen in a bhikkhu named Arita, formerly of the vulture killers. So whether he lived in a place where there were killer vultures, or whether he killed vultures for a living, or his family did, or what, I don't know. But that's the name he's known by. So here's the pernicious view. As I understand the Dhamma, which means the teaching or the law, taught by the Blessed One, which means the Buddha, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. And on my text it has a little footnote, right? I don't know whether your text does. And I think this is the footnote that says what they're talking about here is especially sexual conduct. Hi, sweet Terry. Oh no, it says in making this assertion he is directly contradicting, while reflecting in seclusion, that this bhikkhu decided, while reflecting in seclusion, he came to the conclusion that there would be no harm if bhikkhus were to engage in sexual relations with women. And he maintained that this should not be prohibited by the monastic rules. So the monastic rules for men say that, you know, you should not have sexual relationships. Though his statement does not expressly mention the sexual issue, the similes about sensual pleasure brought forth by the bhikkhus lend credence to the commentary that this is what he was talking about. So, several bhikkhus, having heard about this, went to the bhikkhu Arita and asked him, "Friend Arita, is it true that such a pernicious view has arisen in you?" "Exactly so, friends. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them." Then these bhikkhus, desiring to detach him from that pernicious view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus, "Friend Arita, do not say so. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus. For in many discourses, the Blessed One has stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. The Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasure provides little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. With the simile of the skeleton, with the simile of the piece of meat, with the simile of the grass torch, with the simile of the pit of coals, with the simile of the dream, with the simile of the borrowed goods, with the simile of the tree laden with fruit, with the simile of the slaughterhouse, with the simile of the sword stake, with the simile of the snake's head, the Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them." So do you suppose that's true, that if you have a sensual pleasure and you have something that you really desire and it's very sensual kind of quality and you want a particular feeling, you want a particular high, you want to have an orgasm, you want to get stoned, you want to have more to eat, you want to go to sleep, whatever, does it last?
No.
If you keep going after it, is there a price? Son of a bitch, eh? Do you think he's right? Could it be?
What does the word simile mean?
Simile means using this as an example of. Simile is what many of my friends accuse me of, always telling a story when I ask them a question. When they ask me a question, I usually answer with a story. Okay? Yet although pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by them in this way, the Bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killer, still obstinately adhered to that pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Since the bhikkhus were unable to detach him from that pernicious view, they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, "Venerable sir, since we could not detach the Bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers," I love the way they keep putting that in there, "from this pernicious view, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." Then the Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu thus, "Come, bhikkhu, tell the Bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers, in my name, that the teacher calls him." "Yes, vulnerable sir, venerable sir, he replied. And he went to the Bhikkhu Arita and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Arita." "Yes, friend," he replied, and he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then asked him, "Arita, is it true that the following pernicious view has arisen in you? As I understand the Dharma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct those who engage in them, one who engages in them. Misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dharma in this way?"
Well, you skipped some.
Did I?
Exactly so.
Venerable. Oh, yeah, exactly so, venerable sir. Yeah, he acknowledges it. Yeah. And so he's going to say the same thing. So can I skip the rest of that paragraph? Is that okay? Is that all right? Okay. "Misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dharma in that way? Misguided man, in many discourses, have I not stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them? I have stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, much despair, and how great is the danger with them. And I'm going to skip because he goes through all his similes again, and we're doing this reading for the second time, so that's good. You've got a copy. If you want to take it home and read it, you can check it yourself. And we'll go to the last sentence. But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Why? Why? Because when you keep repeating a habit, it makes it more easy to repeat that habit. You feel like that's really you, don't you? Any of you have any bad habits that you tend to repeat? And do you ever feel like that's quite all right to do that? It's not a problem? Yeah. Well, it's just my nose. You know, you have 1,001 ways, don't you? To like just glaze it over, you know? Okay, you know, some of my bad habits are worse than picking my nose, I admit it. But still, there is that quality of, you know, like when you repeat an action, it becomes reinforced in your being, doesn't it? So there is always that message going yin 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 at you, isn't there? Don't you think that's true? Have you seen yourself do that?
Uh-huh.
Goodie! Then I'm not talking to a bunch of people who don't know what I'm talking about. So when that happens, how long does it take before you realize that that's the habit speaking, not your sense of self? How long does it take to be able to separate those two?
Long.
Yeah, it takes until you really actually see that you are not all your thoughts. And you don't see that as long as you're clinging to what you like or dislike. Is that true? Am I making any sense here? As long as I think that there is something that makes it all right for me to like or dislike, and that's different than you like or dislike, that long I'm not going to turn around and question, why should I believe this thought? So those thoughts eventually are going to come at a time where it's going to wear me down and my finger's going to be up my nose. Isn't it? I mean, it's inevitable, isn't it? Until you actually turn and start watching the mind and saying, well, you know, what triggered that thought? It's basically empty because I don't believe that that's me. But what triggered that thought? How does that thought come up now? Oh, because that's when I used to put my finger up my nose. Okay, but do I really want my finger up my nose right now? No, I would rather have it in my ear. Like there are other orifices, you know? Like there are other possibilities. Either the desire comes up, you believe the desire, you just don't believe the action. Oh, here's this desire. Isn't that nice? You can actually look at the desire without having to go into where we went before. So desire becomes a new thing. And I'll tell you quite frankly, if you don't habituate your desires and you keep your mind inquisitive, that is how to come to liberation from dissatisfactoriness. The fact that we are all yearning for something is because we know that there's something we're missing. But thinking it's going to be something in the sensual realm, in the realm of the senses, which is made up of everything that's separated from totality as well. Isn't that true? In order for something to exist, it has to stop being everything, doesn't it? In order for this to stop being the ground, to become a cup, it had to release its claydom, and go through a process of appearing. And there is a part of it that is following the yearning to get back to claydom. Am I being obscure, or are you following me here? Sort of obscure? Whenever there is form, there is something left out. Because this is a cup, it's not a plate. right? And 50,000 other things. A mud pie for a kid. Billions of things. Part of a rice paddy. The potential for everything is stopped when there's one thing. One thing, however, is impermanent. It comes into being and passes away. So whenever there is one thing, it's subject to dissatisfactoriness. That yearning is for totality in our minds, in our hearts. Anyway, I shouldn't be doing this. I should be going on, because that's what he does in the sutra, isn't it? Do you remember that?
Actually, I don't.
Okay, that's fine. Do you remember it, Carrie? No, okay. Carry on, Cecily. Okay. So where are we on 7?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, what do you think? There it is, one of my favorite of the Buddhist sayings. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this dharma and discipline? And they say, how could he, Venerable Sir? No, Venerable Sir. When this was said, the bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers, do you understand what the Buddha is asking them with that question? Yeah, what is he asking?
He's asking if he's got a right view.
Yeah, has he got even the spark of understanding from that? Yeah. Formerly of the vulture killers sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping, head down, glum, and without response. Then knowing this, the Blessed One told him, misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view. I shall question the bhikkhus on this matter. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, do you understand the Dharma taught by me as this bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers, does when he misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit? No, Venerable Sir, for in many discourses the Buddha has stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. That Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, much despair, and how great is the danger in them. And then they go through the similes. Good bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dharma taught by me thus. For in many discourses I have stated how obstructive things are obstructive, are obstructions, and so forth through the similes. How great is the danger in them. But this bhikkhu Arita, formerly of the vulture killers, misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit. For this will lead to this misguided man's harm and suffering for a long time. Because that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desire, without perceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire, that's impossible. Here, because some misguided men learn the Dharma, discourses, stanzas, expositions, verses, exclamations, sayings, birth stories, marvels, and answers to questions. They learn it all intellectually, but having learned the Dharma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Instead, they learn the Dharma only for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dharma. Those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. He would turn back on him and bite his hand or his arm or one of his limbs.
And because of that, he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, here, some misguided men learn the Dharma. These teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Here, because some clansmen learn the Dharma, discourses, answers to questions, they examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they gain a reflective experience of them. They do not learn the Dharma for the sake of criticizing others, for winning in debates, and they experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dharma. Those teachings, being rightly grasped by them, conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Supposing a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and caught it rightly with a cleft stick, and having done so, grasped it rightly by the neck. Then, although the snake might wrap its coils round his hand, or his arms, or his limbs, still he would not come to death or deadly suffering because of that. Why? Because of his right grasp of the snake. So to hear some clansmen learn the Dharma, those teachings being rightly grasped by them, conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Therefore, bhikkhus, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those bhikkhus who are wise. Don't just believe without asking. Bhikkhus, I shall show you how the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing and over, not for the purpose of grasping. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Then he thought, there is this great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear, but there is no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. You see, this is a simile. Then, when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would the man be doing what should be done with that raft?
No, venerable sir.
By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? Here, bhikkhus, when that man got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with that raft. So I have shown you how the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. So the same thing for sensual pleasures, he's saying, is true for the Dharma. You're grasping after sensual pleasures. Cannot be done, right? See that verse, the last verse on the before the simile of the snake. On the first part, he says, "Bhikkhus, that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without desire, without perception of sensual desire, without seeing something that one desires, without thoughts of sensual desire, without feeding that with your mind," right? First there is the desire, then there is the object, and then there is the self who keeps feeding that. right? Isn't there? So he says, that is impossible. It is impossible. Those three things have to be there before there's desire for a sensual object. Now he's saying the same thing basically about Dharma. Using a teaching, using a raft, and then grasping and clinging to it after you've crossed to safer water. Isn't that what he says? Because when you know the Dharma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even good states. Right? No, wait a minute. I've shown you how the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. You see that? That he's basically talking about the same thing. You don't see it?
Yeah, but I don't understand.
Basically, what the Buddha is doing in this teaching is saying it's not the object, it's the grasping.
And the wrongful use of it.
It's not the object, it's the grasping. Like, don't say, well, it's all right to do this, or, you know, as if it was about whether sex is good or bad. It has nothing to do with that. It's about what kind of grasping is being fed here. It's not about the acquisition. It's about the addiction. Does that make sense? It's not about... It isn't, and over and over and over again in Buddhism they say that you cannot tell what is going on by an action. You can tell by the motive. Right? You get that, don't you? I'm hoping you get that.
By the motive in the sense of what moves you to do something.
Yeah. So it says, bhikkhus, when you know the Dharma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even good states, let alone bad states. So that's how he's saying, it isn't a matter of sensual pleasures being good or bad. It's a matter of, it isn't the action that is good or bad, it's look at what is driving it, what is the grasping. Because this teaching is about servitude. This teaching is, are you caught by your desires, or are they winds that you can use to go where you want? You know, that's what this teaching is all about. It's about liberation from being caught, being subject. First you like this, then you like that. First you have to have this, and then you have to have that. First you're driven to be good, then you're driven to be bad. Is that true?
Yeah.
Any of you ever experienced that in your lives? One or two of you? So knowing that, and then become, well, he goes on. Shall I just shut up and read this? Yes, Cecily, do that. Thank you, Cecily. Because there are these six standpoints for views. What are the six? Here, bhikkhus, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones is unskilled and undisciplined in their dharma. Who has no regard for true men is an unskilled and undisciplined in their dharma. Regards material form thus. So this is somebody who hasn't got a clue about seeing things as they are, basically. It says, oh, this is mine. This is mine. This is who I am. I am somebody who always has a bell and a dorje under my right armpit. This is myself. This is, you know, whatever it is. I always wear green. I never wear green. I always eat coconut. I never eat coconut. I've always liked that. I've never liked that. Right? I've always been this way. I'll never be this way. That is like not really, that's not turning around and looking at the desire. That's just being driven by it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. maybe a person who defines himself a lot by what they do rather than some other sense of being. I'm the carpenter, or I'm the plumber, or I'm a whatever.
And two people can say exactly that. One person can say, I'm the carpenter. And another person can say, I'm the carpenter. And one is saying, I am the carpenter. Fuck off, all the rest of you. I'm the one who carpents. Right? And another person is saying, you know, oh, I got a hammer in my hand. Yeah, I'm the carpenter. Okay, now I got a Dorjean bell in my hand. Oh, yeah, I'm the Tibetan monk. Oh, yeah, now I got... Where the motive actually is part of that being non-self-grasping, non-grasping, when the motive is not grasping. There's a whole different... Have you ever actually enjoyed, like you were, Ivan, playing with the cat? That was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there wasn't any sense of grasping or not grasping?
Oh, with the cat.
Absolutely. Okay, but that's after the fact. That's after the fact.
Okay.
When you're doing it, it's like, it's just fun, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
And there's just this openness, and there's not any grasping or non-grasping, is there? You're not trying to make it different than it is, or it's just the heart is just open, right? So when the mind is like that, you can say, I'm a carpenter, and it's not a problem. But if the mind is, I'm the carpenter here.
It has an agenda behind.
That's exactly it. When somebody has an agenda, or believes in that they have to have an agenda, or holds on to an agenda, there is that quality of holding it, you know, of like holding it like that, like it's like we wear a mask in front of ourselves. You know, well, this is who I am. You walk down the street and you have to have your front ready.
Is there a difference between the clinging and grasping? Is it the same thing?
The clinging is sustained grasping.
Hanging on.
Clinging is grasping is like that. Clinging is
okay.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Okay. He regards his feelings. This is mine. This I am. This is myself. I am happy. I am sad. I am tired. I am bored. Right? He regards perception. I know it's true because I saw it. This is mine. This I am. This is myself. He regards formations as, this is mine. This I am. This is myself. Whatever is coming up now in your life. Inner or outer, right, actually. But he regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And this, and does, isn't that exactly how commercials are so popular? How they work, how ads on the radio or TV, you know, isn't it? It's like, oh, you should be like this, oh, you should be like this. Or chapters, whoops. Did I say that? Larry and I went shopping yesterday.
And
this is my brother. My brother Larry. And there are some genes that we share. Not genes, but genes. We couldn't share the other genes anymore, but because he's gained weight and I've lost it. But the inner genes we share. And one of them is books. And we both just went a little nuts, you know, in chapters. We both spend more money than we usually spend in a year on books. In one afternoon, it felt great. Where did that come from? Grasping commercials, right? That whole quality of when I'm reaching for a book, I watch myself. Like, it's a good thing they don't have a big poetry section in chapters, because I would be sunk, glove down the drain. But it's bad enough already, because there's all these things that you would like to have or read, but then there's a little image of time. But in the moment of buying, oh yeah, I want this. I am. You can feel it, can't you? In the moment of reaching, oh, this is it. This is me. At this standpoint for views, namely, this is self. This is the world. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. That's what's behind it, isn't it? I am something solid. Whether it's I am solid good, I am solid bad, doesn't matter. I am something solid. I shall endure as long as eternity. This too he regards. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. A well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones is skilled and disciplined in their dharma, who has regard for true men skilled and disciplined in their dharma, regards material form thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Looking at yourself now and 10 years ago, is there a difference in your body? You know, I shrunk an inch in the last year and a half. An inch shorter than I was a year and a half ago. Isn't that incredible? The earth energy, from a Buddhist point of view, the earth energy is slowly sucking in. The body is starting now on its dissolution run. You know? 66, 65, 66, 67, you know. And I'm on the downslope, folks. The mind's starting to go away. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Is this body who was the I 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? You see what I'm saying? This morning. I was a dyed-in-the-wool Scorpio. This afternoon, I tended more towards Libranism. Who knows what tonight will end, right? It's like continuously this change of the self. Isn't there? Isn't it always fluctuating? Playing with the cat's one thing, not playing with the cat's another. Different self in each case. Where there's a different object, there's a different subject. Where there's a different subject, there's a different object, even if you don't move. He regards feeling that way. He regards perception that way. He regards formations that way. He regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered that way. And this standpoint for views, namely, this is self, this is the world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity. This too he regards that way. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Ne tam mama. Ne soham asmi. Na me so ata. That's how you say that in Pali. It's a mantra that people practice. Just walk around saying that to themselves. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Ne tam mama.
Okay, so why don't you repeat that again?
Ne tam mama.
Ne tam mama.
Ne so hamasmi, na me so ata. It's very nice with your feet. Ne tam mama, ne so hamasmi, na me so ata. Very nice walking mantra.
So that you can do that when you're walking.
Yeah, it's a very nice mantra for walking. And it actually helps, doesn't it? Isn't it, Terry? You've done that mantra, haven't you? Didn't you a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
It's useful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really starts, wait a minute. Sometimes you get pissed off.
Oh yeah, well who is it then? I'm walking.
But you actually start asking those questions. You know, you don't just ignore it and never really question, well, who do I think, who is the I that thinks I'm an I? That's a good question. Where does that come from? Since he regards them thus, he is not agitated about what is non-existent. Not agitated by what is non-existent. I like that. Venerable, when this was said, a certain bhikkhu asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, can there be agitation about what is non-existent externally? Can you be agitated about something that doesn't exist out there? You follow that question? Good question, eh?
Yeah.
There can be, says the Buddha. There can be, bhikkhu. Here, bhikkhu, someone thinks thus, alas, I had it. Oh, I had perfect love. Oh, I had better energy. Oh, I had a good job. I don't know how many, especially women I met, who have told me that they were in a relationship, and actually they hated the relationship. It really sucked. But as soon as it broke up, who is it? One of the... Marion Woodman, or one of the Jungian psychiatrists, calls it the ghostly lover syndrome. Because the lover isn't there, suddenly they become perfect. Ah, oh, how I could have let that go. You know? So it's kind of fun to laugh about it, but when you're caught in it, it's just pure unadulterated suffering. So, can there be agitation about what is non-existent? Can there be alas, I had it. Alas, I have it no longer. Alas, may I have it again. Alas, I do not get it. Then he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. This is how there is agitation about what is non-existent externally. It's such common sense in a way, isn't it? But not when we're doing it. Somehow it's not common, that kind of sense. When we're caught in one of those patterns, it's not very common for us to see it, is it? See how important it is to actually think about this in a cool mind state? You actually get a chance. Venerable Sir, can there be no agitation about what is non-existent? Externally? Okay, I feel that a lot. Is it ever possible not to do that? There can be, bhikkhu, the Blessed One said. Here, bhikkhu, someone does not think. Alas, I had it. Alas, I have it no longer. Alas, may I have it. Alas, I do not get it. Then he does not sorrow, grieve, lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. That is how there is no agitation about what is non-existent externally.
Get over it.
Exactly, that's exactly what I'm saying. And like I said, when in a good mood, it's easy to see that. It's in those other moods that, you know, you may have to use your mind a little bit to think about it beforehand so that you can imagine yourself, like, maybe not being so caught.
Don't you understand that, like, you're grasping after something that's non-existent?
Yeah, like a love affair that you had, but it's gone. And then saying, oh, I wish I had that again, or a job, or... Some people, they go over conversations they had and they say, oh, I wish I'd said it that way or I said it this way, right?
Yeah.
But it's not there.
Okay.
Oh, alas, I don't have it. Oh, alas, I wish I'd, oh, I didn't understand. Oh, I should have said, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And is it possible to not be upset over things? So the idea, you know, somebody says something and you have this sense of, oh, you could say this, but you don't say it. And so you don't think, oh, I wish I had, or I should have. You just say, no, oh, this is what is.
Perfect coffee pot.
You got it. You got it. I love it when everybody adds. Perfect coffee pot. It's a koan. Is this another question for your brewing? Or?
You said that she wants perfect coffee pot. You said this is a koan.
Koan. For me.
Oh, koan.
It's a koan for you because you got it. Okay. It's a koan for me because it could be.
It could be, okay.
Yeah. You know my favorite story about the guru on the mountaintop with the lotus?
No.
Never mind. Some other day. Because we got a little bit more to cover here. And so then we've settled the external, right? Whether something is existent or non-existent, what is non-existent externally, can there be no agitation about what is non-existent externally? So now, can there be agitation what about what is non-existent internally?
It's all non-existent.
There can be, Bhikkhu, the Blessed One said. Someone has the view, this is self, this the world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity. He hears the Tathagata, disciple of the Tathagata, teaching the Dhamma for the elimination of all standpoints, decisions, obsessions, adherences, and underlying tendencies. That's what the Dhamma is, right? For the elimination of all fixed things. That is so interesting, isn't it? This is the Buddha's description. For the stilling of all formations, for the relinquishing of all attachments. This is exactly why Dharma scares the heaven, hell, and earth out of me. Because I'm fairly sane, you see. And there is one part of my being that knows if I ever actually gave up all fixed views, there would be an experience that transcended subject based on object, no longer in relation to. Is that straightforward? Can you be present and universal? Move the mind to a universal experience? Or is the mind already universal and I am clouding it with subject-object duality? This is what this is getting at, isn't it? For the destruction of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana, for peace. He thinks thus. So when there can be bhikkhu, for someone who has a view, this is self, this is the world, when he hears the teaching, then what he hears is, so I shall be annihilated, so I shall perish, so I shall be no more. Because he believes there is a self, right? Thus he sorrows, grieves, and laments, he weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. That is how there is agitation about what is non-existent internally. Because there is no fixed self.
So there is no agitation. In this text.
No, I haven't got to that one yet. I'm on verse 20. Venerable sir, can there be no agitation about what is non-existent internally? There can be bhikkhus. Here, bhikkhus, someone does not have the view, this is self, I shall endure as long as eternity, I am permanent, I am me, I am. It's not a fixed view. You see, you're able to see the shifts and changes of the sense of self as different objects come in, different subjects arise. Isn't that true? Come to the front door, one person meets you you've never seen, you go to the back door, you come in a different way, you come up here, it's all a bunch of different selves. And they all rise without a problem and they all dissolve and the next one rises. There's this continuous flow of subject-object. But one fixed identity there, it doesn't exist. Even the body is flowing in its changes, isn't it? He hears, and then he hears, he does not have that view. He hears the Tathagata, a disciple, teaching the Dharma for the elimination of standpoints, decisions, obsessions, adherences, and underlying tendencies, for the stilling of all formations, for the relinquishing of all attachments, for the destruction of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana. He does not think thus. So I shall be annihilated, so I shall perish. He's watched the self rise and fall. First there's a desire, you sit and watch it, then it dissolves. There's one self who's desiring, then there's another self who could care less. Is that true? Then he does not sorrow, grieve, lament, he does not weep, beating his breast and become distraught. This is how there is no agitation about what is non-existent internally. You may well acquire that possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. But do you see any such possession? You know, maybe you will get something that will never change, will be permanent, will be eternal. But have you seen anything like that? I love the way he asks these questions. No, venerable sir, they all say. No, I haven't. Have you? No. How about you? No, not me either. No, sir. Good bhikkhus, I too do not see any possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. Because you may well cling to that doctrine of self that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. But do you see any such doctrine of self? Is there a self that is never subject to suffering? No, venerable sir, I haven't seen one that is like constant, steady, unchanging, and not subject to suffering. Nope. Good, because I too do not see any doctrine of self that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. What goes up must come down. Because you may well take as a support that view that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who takes it as a support. But do you see any such supportive views? Do you see a support, a way to, you know? No, venerable sir. Good, because I too do not see any such supportive view. do not see any supportive views that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who takes on support. There being a self, would there be what belongs to myself? Yes, venerable sir. Or there being what belongs to a self, that would there be myself? Yes, venerable sir. Because since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended as true and established, then this standpoint for views, meaning, namely, this is self, this is the world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity, would it not be an utterly and completely foolish teaching? What else could it be, venerable sir? It would be an utterly and completely foolish teaching. Because, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded? This is mine, this I am, this is myself? No, venerable sir. What do you think? Is feeling, perception, formations, consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded? This is mine, this I am, this is myself? No, venerable sir. Therefore, because any kind of material form whatever, whether past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of feeling, any kind of perception, any kind of formations, any kind of consciousness, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Seeing thus, Vikas, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with feeling. Disenchanted, I think that's a very good word to use, not enchanted with. Not, you know, when you're enchanted with something, you tend to gloss over its bad points because you just remember the good ones. You know that, don't you? You've seen yourself do that. You become disenchanted. You can see it clearly with perception. Disenchanted with formation. Disenchanted with consciousness. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. This is liberation. It comes the knowing. Oh, this is liberation from being subject. Being subject. Subjected. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This bhikkhu is called one whose shaft has been lifted, whose trench has been filled in, whose pillar has been uprooted, one who has no bar, a noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered. And how is the bhikkhu one whose shaft has been lifted? The bhikkhu has abandoned ignorance. Ignorance means ignoring, not seeing things as they are, willful or unwillful. Has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future arising. How is the bhikkhu one whose trench has been filled? The bhikkhu has abandoned the round of births that bring renewed being, has cut it off at the root so that no longer subject to future arising. How is the bhikkhu one whose pillar has been uprooted? The bhikkhu has abandoned craving, has cut it off at the root so is no longer subject to future arising. How is the bhikkhu one who has no bar? Bhikkhu has abandoned the five lower fetters, has cut them off at the root, so they are no longer subject to future arising. How is the bhikkhu a noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered? A bhikkhu has abandoned the conceit, I am, has cut it off at the root, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. That is how the bhikkhu is a noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered. They're basically a desire for an experience other than that which is present is the first one. Do you remember that?
No, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Desire for an experience other than what is present is the number one. And the second one. What's the second one? I get them mixed up in the order now.
The frustration, the anger frustration, is that the same set?
Vichikicca and Udacca Kukucca.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to remember the right order. I think it's desire for an experience other than that which is present. The second one is anger, isn't it?
Weird. There's anger and then frustration.
Anger, and then the third one is... Sloth and torpor, and the fourth one is pickiness, and because after the sloth and torpor, then there starts to be pickiness and sense of udacca kukucca. It's like pickiness and agitation, and then the last one is skepticism. So first one, I want something. Second one, I didn't get it. Third one is like restlessness and torpor and kind of like... And then the next one is like I can't remember the order right now, I'm sorry. But they're basically, they pretty well follow one another, and it ends up saying, I don't believe that shit anyway. So that you want something, you don't get it. You know, what's that fairy tale about the monkey who wanted wanted some grapes or something, one of Aesop's, wasn't it? He was jumping for the grapes and he couldn't reach them. And so where we get the saying sour grapes is from that one. Ah, they were sour anyway, he says, and goes off. That's where the expression sour grapes in English comes from, that story. So, and that's basically desire, because eventually it will not satisfy all desire. Eventually, next desire will arise, or the next, you know, a bigger one, a better one. Because a desire is not really about objects, or highs, or lows, or ups, or downs, or love affairs, or hate affairs. Those are just ongoing politics, aren't they? What we really want is to find that part of ourselves that has never been outside of totality, right? That part of ourselves that is always, that knows things as they are. So when we don't get an outer thing, then we tend to go skeptical. This is how the five end up. Is that okay? Okay. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? So how far are we gone? We got the 36 now, right? When the gods with Indra and Brahman with Pajapati seek a bhikkhu who is thus liberated in mind. Because when there is an experience of liberation from subject-object, from subject-object identity, from being caught in subject-object identity, being subject to dissatisfiedness, being subject to experiences, when the mind has gone beyond duality, then the mind is also dwelling on all the realms at the same time. So then there is no problem seeing the gods are sort of what we would call the higher angels. Does that make sense? You know, seraphim and cherubim, you remember all those things? Any of you? Are you that? Far out. Goody. Goody. You must. I hope so. We had a similar upbringing. So, there are these many realms, and some of them are real hell realms, and some of them are very fine material realms where it's almost like mind only. There are many realms in which consciousness interacts with form in a very profound way. That is what we are all doing. We are all living on all the realms. But we tend to focus more on one, at least be caught by one subject-object. So that when you have an experience beyond the subject-object, then there is this quality of those beings who live in the better real estate areas of town, in the higher class mansions of the town, universal town of the universe. They tend to like drop in and see how you're doing, because they want to know, you know, whether you know an investment that they should get involved in, basically. Because even the best neighborhoods can become slums, can't they? And will, at some time or other, won't they? Basically.
Maybe only the best ones can really become slums.
Yeah. When the gods with Indra and Brahma with Pajapati seek a bhikkhu is thus liberated in mind, they do not find anything of which they could say, the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. Why is that? One thus gone, I say, is untraceable here and now. When the consciousness returns to totality, there's nothing to trace. To the opens to the original state of totality, there is nothing to trace. There's nothing to be separate from. There's nothing, therefore, that you can name, that can be named. You know, in tarot, they say the high priestess is a virgin because there's nothing she's separate from, so therefore she cannot be made impure. It's when it has to be the duality before something can be pure and something not. So when the gods, who have this most fine ability to see the most fine material planes, see no trace of anything that supports the awakened. That's what it's saying. There's no way you can trace even with the most subtle senses. So saying bhikkhus, so proclaiming, I have been baselessly, vainly, falsely, and wrongly represented by some recluses and brahmins. Thus, the recluse Gotama is one who leads astray, teaches the annihilation, the destruction, the extermination of existing being. Some people still think that Buddhism is about annihilation. They don't think that self-grasping is about annihilation because it's impossible. Because the self is always changing, and the object is always changing. But to, you know, did you ever see that movie Samsara? It's quite a lovely movie. It's all about desire. You can rent it, I think, can't you? It's really worth renting. Samsara, it's called. It's a Tibetan movie. And it starts with this puzzle, like, how do you keep a drop of water from evaporating? And in the end, the answer is by returning it to the ocean. By letting go of the separateness. So this is what this is talking about, isn't it? And so his critics say he is one who leads astray, teaches annihilation, destruction, the extermination of an existing being. Is the drop of water exterminated by the ocean? It's just non-differentiated. There's a difference. It's in a whole other realm. As I am not, as I do not proclaim, so have I been baselessly, vainly, falsely, and wrongly misrepresented by some recluse and Brahmins thus. The recluse Gotama is one who leads astray, teaches the annihilation, the destruction, the extermination of an existing being. Both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering. There is the whole path. This is dissatisfactoriness. This is the end of dissatisfactoriness. That's what the Buddha teaches. This is dissatisfactoriness. This is the end. If others abuse, revile, scold, harass the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account feels no annoyance, no distress, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. If others honor, respect, revere, and venerate the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account feels no delight, joy, or elation of the heart. Whatever. If others honor, respect, revere, and venerate the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account thanks us. They perform such services as these for the sake of what had earlier come to be fully understood. They are venerated what has already happened. What was an earlier accomplishment. There's nobody there now. They are venerating the moment when the water is about to drop, the drop of water is about to fall into the ocean. But when they venerate the Buddha, it's the ocean. How do you find the drop that is the water? There is no separateness. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's like another realm. We're talking another realm. Not subject-object. I love this sutra because I think it really starts to point that. If you read it a few times, you start to get that, what is really being talked about here. Therefore, bhikkhus, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass you on that account, you should not entertain any annoyance, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. If others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you on that account, you should not entertain any delight, joy, or elation of the heart. You should not entertain. You know, things may arise and fall, but you don't entertain them. You don't get involved. If others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you on that account, you should think thus. They perform such services as these for the sake of what had earlier come to be fully understood. They're seeing the fruits of the sowing, the fruits of the crop, of what was all the labor. Therefore, bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. What is it that is not yours? Material form is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Feeling is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Perception is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Formations are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. What do you think if people carried off the grass, sticks, branches, and leaves in this Jetta grove, or burned them, or did what they liked with them? Would you think people are carrying us off, or burning us, or doing what they like with us? No, venerable sir, why not? Because that is neither ourself nor what belongs to ourself. So too, bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. What is it that is not yours? Material form, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. The Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork, there is no future round for manifestation in the case of those bhikkhus who are arahats with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. That's basically the chant of what is the Buddha, that Iti Piso Bhagava, that's what it is translated. Bhikkhus, the Dhamma, well proclaimed by me, thus clear, free of patchwork, and the Dharma well proclaimed by me, thus which is clear, free of patchwork, those bhikkhus who have abandoned the five lower fetters are all due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. The Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, free of patchwork, and the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, free of patchwork, those bhikkhus who have abandoned the three lower fetters and attenuated lust, hate, and delusion are all once returners, returning once to this world to make an end to suffering. The Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, free of patchwork, and the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, free of patchwork, those bhikkhus who have abandoned three fetters are all stream enterers, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, and headed for enlightenment. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, free of patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, free of patchwork, those bhikkhus who are Dharma followers or faith followers are all headed for enlightenment. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, open, evident, free of patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork, those bhikkhus who have sufficient faith in me, sufficient love for me, are all headed for heaven. That's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. No, I'm just saying why we finished 15 minutes earlier this time than we did last time we ran. So, what?
Why does the Buddha call heaven?
There are different heaven realms, and some of them are heaven realms where there is just the pure, blissful delight of consciousness without any sense of subject-object identity, just the bliss. You know, when you have been totally concentrated on something, like when you have an orgasm or, you know, some great experience happens and just for a moment everything stops and your mind is just one-pointed, how blissful that is. Imagine that multiplied by 100,000. So that's like the kind of bliss that you can experience that will cause that from practicing meditations that develop concentration. And that would bring that totally changes the addiction or the desire of that consciousness. So then at death, rebirth, whatever that consciousness is doing, there is a strong drive to live in a realm where there is just that total blissfulness. So there could be, say, rebirth in, I'm going to use beings, could be rebirth, although that isn't exactly, I find rebirth in, although it isn't exactly true, but it'll do. That desire will create a rebirth in a God realm that is a fine material form realm, and it's just pure unadulterated bliss. It is an experience of without subject object, but it's not based on actually having destroyed the attachments. It's based on like being on a trampoline and jumping up really high and thinking you're flying, but eventually gravity starts and you settle again. So that's one kind of heaven realm. Another kind of, there's all kinds of heaven realms. There's some where beings have rudimentary, the six senses, and they're sort of more like the angels that we think about. And there's one of the heaven, some of the heaven realms, actually, you can hear a teaching, you can hear a teaching that helps you achieve liberation. So the heavens he's talking about in this sutra are those kinds of heavens where it's very blissful, but it's not so blissful that you just totally get blissed out and you think that's you. Because when you fall out of those total blissful realms, what happens is you get pissed off because it didn't last, right? And the craving to be back there is so strong, right? So usually you end up in a hell realm. You go from bliss to hell to bliss to hell. Like that? So some of the heaven realms you can actually receive teaching. And the Tibetans have these different realms. They have Amitabha is the Buddha of perception, the Buddha of discrimination. And he has his own special heaven realm. Well, he has a whole bunch of them, but the main one, if you're really a good person and you do all your prayers right and you belong to some Mahayana traditions, a lot of the main belief is that if you keep saying these prayers, let's say you keep bringing your perception to the wishing for kindness for all beings, then you'll be reborn in this realm. And you'll be reborn on a lotus. The lotus will open, you'll be sitting in front of the Buddha, Amitabha, and he'll teach you. He'll be teaching. But there are people who do all of the necessary prayers to get there, but they're always thinking about what they're going to get next. So they can be born in a lotus in front of Amitabha, but the lotus never opens. So even though they're there, they're not there. Because when people are somewhere, but they're always thinking about what they're going to get next, they're there, but they're not there. So this is like the way the Tibetans work this. You know, they talk about, may you be born in a lotus that opens in the land of Amitabha. Because there are stories about people who are born in a lotus that didn't open. So they were there, but like what? Oh, was that it? Oh, I should have gone off there.
Schrodinger's cat.
Huh?
Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm.
Thank you.
So he's talking about the kind of heaven where you can get teaching, because he's talking about the wish to awaken being the reason you would be born in a heaven realm. So isn't that interesting? I hope you found, I know it was a longer one and we kind of plowed through it, and for those of you who are the first time, it must have been a bit, but I hope you survived it. It was sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Good. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
One question. In this part where you're explaining what you were afraid of, or letting go of, or something?
Sorry?
Are you afraid of something, letting go of something?
I said that there are many times in my life where I really do not want to let go of the sense of self, of meaning. For example, earlier when I lived in, as you know, I lived in Thailand for a period of time. And I was studying some Abhidhamma and meditating a lot, and I was also studying the five aggregates, trying to understand the five aggregates in particular from the Abhidhamma. And I didn't have any problem that form was not self. Form. You know. The truck kind of helped me with that one. Gave me a little extra push in that direction. Geez, you could die any moment. Who would you be then? You know, so I was hit by a truck when I was a teenager. So that was within my grasp. Feelings, well, you know. I could understand that because when I was really pissed off and bitter, I used to like arguing people into the opposite feeling. Because I knew that whatever you felt was hogwash. Didn't matter in the world, you know, when I was like really being cynical and a real stupid bitch. That's my favorite thing to do. Perception, well, you know, drugs. I mean, I knew that drugs were, I mean, perception was not self. Played with perception a lot, okay? Mental formations, I could accept that. But then when it came to consciousness is not self, I'm going, excuse me? I am this total, open, gleaming consciousness who understands that form, feeling, perception, and mental formations are not self. What's your problem? You know, like, and I watched that kind of sense come and go throughout my life at various times. Is this sort of like little grasping over it? Yeah, but then what? You know, that little hiccup of, oh yeah, but then what? Who will I, you know, like if I quit smoking, what will I do with my hands? Have you ever had a habit where if you stopped it, you didn't know who you were? You know, that kind of thing, like. And who, you know, and who we are is our security blanket, isn't it? It's our ignorance that we wrap around us to keep ourselves safe. In case dot, dot, dot. In case we, in case they, in case it, ooh, ooh, ooh. There's never any real answer to that in case. Is this a wide open, right? Do you understand that, what I'm saying? What? Where did I lose you, dear?
No, you're talking about the consciousness and then not consciousness.
I'm saying I could accept, because of the experiences of this life, I accept that form was not self, right? And there's no problem with that. That's just fine. But, you know, consciousness is not self. Excuse me.
Here I am.
So I tried to intellectually trick myself into believing that I believed it, but there was always this kind of... There wasn't any real question about it. I was doing what the Buddha said here. I was pretending to believe it because it was the... Because I was a Buddhist nun living in Thailand and it was the thing to do, you know, basically. But really, I didn't believe it. I felt really pissed off about that. It was like, you know, I was actually found a place where I could be pure consciousness. And not connected with us and all those other, you know. Most of us, we would like to be a drop in the ocean of the similar drops that we have chosen to be there. The ones that we choose not to be there, cut out. And it varies very much who we would let in or out of our ocean, doesn't it? So that's called clinging and grasping to a self, isn't it?
It's deeply biological, isn't it?
It may or may not be. You mean in terms of instinctual?
The whole body fights to live. The whole construction of life is around survival and around maintaining an equilibrium.
And it's not the desire of that that I'm talking about.
No, but the mind pattern that follows
okay.
it and is afraid of it not happening.
This when that desire is running, and if you don't turn around and totally agree with it, big fear comes up. And if you don't feel interested enough and with enough right to just turn around and watch that fear and say, what is this fear? Then of course, yeah, you're caught. So that's exactly what I'm talking about, that experience in myself. How every time I would start to find something where I was afraid to go there. I was afraid to let go of that separateness, let go of that safety, let go of that I'm okay, Jack, kind of quality. Yeah, exactly. And then in the moments where you do let go of that, you have to go through fear. And then when you're going through that fear, there has to be a sense of seeing it as energy. The minute there is an I am afraid, game over. Me versus them again. But when you can watch the emotion as energy, it's not a problem. Yes.
So, where would the word, the ego, fall in all of this? Would this consciousness now still present part of the ego, or is
there's
it
a continuously interest? There's a continuously arising subject object, and then dissolving. Have you watched babies? You ever seen babies, little babies? Mm-hmm. Before they had words? Is there a self there? Aware of other? Absolutely. But there isn't any clinging to any one self. If the self is aware of a sense of a stomach ache or being hungry or wanting to be picked up or, you know, there is no problem expressing that, and then the next moment letting it go, and then the next self arises, right? You don't have to worry about self or ego. It's continuously arising in relation. The point is that it's impermanent, coming into being, passing away. It is not a fixed identity. That's the point. When we think of self, when we give it a name and say ego and me and I, there is a kind of a grasping after a fixed thing that is other than.
So clinging to a consciousness.
Clinging to a consciousness was
an ego.
It was an identity for me. Whoever me meant, you know, okay, you know, there was all these other experiences. But there was some part of the being that never abandoned a sense that there was refuge. Even in some of my most insane and most stupid moments, both of which I have occasionally dived into. Dove? Diffin? One of them, grammatically truths. Truthful words. Both of which, you know, I've had some interesting little excursions
the
into
diva.
Bullshit. The diva. I have divaed into. That's exactly right. Woohoo! Oh, yeah. But
refuge is an inner.
But the sense. I'll just finish this thought, okay? But the sense of actually a sense of some kind of clarity or something that was way huger than the fear was always somewhere there if I was willing to turn to it in my being. So I considered that as something I did know, and so therefore I could turn my life around, and therefore, you know? So there was a grasping after that. Not to say that that grasping wasn't very useful in my life. Not to say that that grasping was very important to me. Not to say that there are not levels of understanding where your grasp loosens and loosens and loosens. Not saying that that is not final. You know? And like to actually be able to identify, this is not mine, this I am not, to the point where the only identity that remains is universal. Where the only thing that is left is the continuous rising and falling of various different types of fish jumping out of the bloody ocean. Seeing, plop. Is that good? Sorry.
I'm just going to say that in the way that is refuge, having let go, having no longer a sense of self-sustaining or somehow fallen through the gap of recognition and into straight cognition and discovering there's something there holding one up that isn't one, that isn't any sense of being, that one is still refuge. That is refuge.
I totally agree with the feeling. It's the words that are making me go, mm-mm-mm. So I'm just going to shut up on that one. Thank you. Well, oh, that's more than enough, isn't it, for this evening? I mean, now it's like 17 minutes after. 17 minutes of overtime I've done. So you know what your bill's going to be. Or is it John? Is it a John or a Bill? Tom. It has to be male. Bill, John, Tom.
Bill?
Okay. Don? Oh, it's Don!
He's not here.
Yes!
Don, you listening? It's you.
So you know it's this very beautiful gold light in your hearts? Your heart, if you're a Buddhist, like is what your mind is. It's sort of just in front of your spine, but, you know, about where your ribs divide. There's this kind of little light bulb there, this little space with this gold light there, just shining right through your belly button, out your spine, and up through your shoulders and down through your tailbone. And please don't close your eyes or go unholy on me, because I'll just get real pissed off. And it goes down your legs and down your arms and up through your head. And if you sit up any straighter, I'll send my teeth over there. And out your ear balls and out your eyeballs. Out your shoulders. It fills this room. This gold light just fills this room from your heart. Because everybody else's heart's doing it. And this room is just shining right through the whole house, the whole neighborhood. Anybody you want to pray for, you just imagine them just being washed by this light. Ruth, for example. The light just goes out right through the whole planet. George Bush just got hit. That was a good one. So wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily assuaged. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So thank you for your great compassion. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, sister.